Opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You are listening to KFAR Radio. We are at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at KFARradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I am your host, David Pruse. If you want to call into today's show, we're at 907-458-TALK, 907-458-8255. And with that, today's a Wednesday. It's the second Wednesday of the month, which means
we have Nick Nutra with an Alaska history spot.
We're consistent. Mining. That's why we're here.
It is. This is, of course, the month that Golden Days is in. Golden Days activities actually start this evening with a presentation by Joni Skillbred on the history of Golden Days.
You know, Fairbanks, I was mistaken. I thought today, Wednesday, was the start of the Kiwanis pancake, but it wasn't. It's tomorrow, I think.
Oh, man.
The booth is out there in the Saddler's parking lot.
It is.
And I was looking forward to my sourdough pancakes, and it wasn't there.
I certainly remember that one. That was an entire week-long activity.
Yeah. Oh, well, we digress.
So today, what I thought I'd talk about, instead of individuals, which we do quite often, is actually mining itself. What happened? How does it work? A lot of people would look at placer mining today, and you see a dozer pushing material, or a backhoe or something, pushing material into a sluice box. That's not always what we did here, and in fact, sluicing at one point was the least popular form of mining. So a placer is simply a concentrated I want to give a credit too. A lot of the material I have today comes from a paper written by a fellow named John Brayton, who was working on a master's degree. He was a student at Michigan Technological University, and a group from there came up in the summer of 2012. And did an industrial archaeology study on mining. And a lot of what is here is some of the background notes that he had found. Well, a placer then is a concentrated deposit of valuable minerals. It's been displaced from its original source vein and redeposited elsewhere. We're familiar, of course, with gold placers here.
Mm-hmm.
There are tin placers and platinum placers. Tin placers in Malaysia, some of the gold dredges from here and the Klondike were packaged up and shipped to Malaysia, where they went into placer work until the Second World War. Well, placers then are formed when wind, water, gravity, whatever, break the gold, the economic valuable item, away from the rock it's in, and it's deposited. The primary force in placers in the Fairbanks district was running water. The resulting deposit is referred to as alluvium. Alluvial deposits occur when mineral bodies are eroded, displaced, and redeposited. So in the United States, these deposits are called placers, and we use the term placer when describing mineral deposits that are unconsolidated. The minerals within the deposit would be technically called alluvium, as long as they're unconsolidated material. And here, I think the common name we hear is just, they're the gravels. And
yeah,
that's pretty much a good name. So the minerals then are economically valuable and there is, unfortunately with placer mining, there's a lot of non-valuable gravel to move and get rid of in most instances. Well, the native gold found within a placer deposit was originally part of a larger rock body or a quartz vein or some such thing. It contained the load gold. Running water disintegrated the rock body, freezing, thawing, so forth. And then the chunks of gold were moved along the bottom
dispersed.
Of the streams.
They dispersed.
Were over a very large distance. Interestingly enough, in several deposits, the actual original load gold is so worn down in the deposit that they really don't have a load gold that you can trace the deposits back to the mother load, if you will.
Wow.
Well, as the stream changes its course and gets further away from usually the hills, the energy drops and the gold begins to deposit more and more in various locations that are low energy and builds up and accumulates there. The stream will always leave the heaviest deposits in the higher energy, and the smallest deposits, the really fine gold flour, will have to pretty well be in cracks in the bedrock or mm-hmm. something, because it'll just keep moving with the sand, even being much heavier.
Ah, okay.
Well, gold is roughly 7 times denser than other particles within placer sediments. In its pure state, it has a specific gravity of 19.3. Gold found within placers is never pure. It generally is alloyed with some amount of silver. Those were hydrothermal deposits into the bedrock that are weathered out. Placer gold averages a specific gravity of between 19 or 4 through 19. In fact, some placer gold up in the Circle District was so high in fineness that it couldn't be used to directly make coins. Well, the weight and density then lend to its eventual weathering. As everything keeps working with the water, the weight of the gold itself helps break up the other materials that's around. The silver alloy makes the nuggets fairly hard. They won't just mash flat as they move along. We have pay dirt then as everything goes along over the bedrock. The pay dirt is closest to the bedrock, and its thickness or depth to bedrock of placers can be as little as a few inches to as much as 600 feet. The depth of the placer reveals the information for determining if it can be economically mined. Well, placers occur in a variety of locations dependent on where the stream courses concentrated them. And there's creek and bench, which we probably have heard the most of, beach deposits such as those at Nome, Deep Lead, Broad Valley, gold can end up a lot of places. Placer gold deposits in Alaska are categorized into primary groups, which is residual, sorted, and resorted according to how they originally became unconsolidated and how many times water has reworked the deposit. They are further classified based on the age and the location, but that's all kind of technical stuff that we really don't need to know.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a moment and have a commercial break. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fish on! The Valdez Fishing Report is brought to you by Frontier Outfitters. Drop in and explore their extensive fishing department. Rods to reels, lures to lines. You'll see fresh and saltwater as well as fly fishing tackle for every game fish in Alaska. Stock up on supplies for your Alaska-sized summer of fun. Coolers to camping gear. Frontier Outfitters is your first stop to making your next outdoor adventure a success. Your store for the outdoors. Frontier Outfitters for your Alaskan lifestyle.
It's time for the Valdez Fishing Report. Interviews, derby standings, tips, and advice for Prince William Sound.
Lori Prox here with Joy Witte of Valdez. You reeled in a 155.6-pound halibut. I want to know a little bit more about finding your halibut spot. So, you know, what has your journey been trying to find a great spot?
I'm not giving away any secrets. No, I'm joking. It was just looking.
Okay, you can leave now.
Yeah. It was looking at maps and listening to the charter captains, listening to other people's experiences. We go down to the harbor and we do videos of people and we listen to their stories and we just took all that information. We're like, all right, we're putting this to the test. It was 240 feet is where she sat at, and it was just in this great little gully, and it was amazing. So
we're way out.
Yes, we were real far out, but we were in Prince William Sound, which the charter captains were shocked we didn't go out to the Gulf, and they were really excited to hear that there was one that big in Prince William Sound.
Once you hooked it, did you know it was a good one?
Yes. Yeah. You know, when you hook them, you see the bobble and you see it bounce and you get excited and you hook it. But with this one, when I hook it, I hit a wall and my arms just dead stop in the air. And it just, I thought either I'm hooked on the bottom or I am hooked on the biggest fish I've ever seen in my life.
Park your rig, pitch a tent, or check into your private cabin at Eagles Rest RV Resort, then explore Valdez. Eagles Rest RV Resort is the perfect place to land in Valdez. Book RV sites, glamping tents, and cabins online at eaglesrestrv.com. We now accept online reservations for our tent area. Nothing beats summer in Valdez, so the sooner you book, the better. EaglesRestRV.com. See you in Valdez.
KVAK's Valdez Fishing Report. Fish Valdez and reel in a big one.
KFAR weather.
Sunshine mixed with clouds at times this afternoon, with daytime highs approaching 73. Easterly winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Lows level off around 56. Tonight, overcast skies. Slight chance for isolated rain showers. Tomorrow, daytime highs approaching 72. Cloudy skies expected. And that's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio here with me, and we are just talking about mining, different styles, types, how it's done, what is produced, and how it's produced, and what you're looking for.
Yes. Something that just kind of put out as general knowledge, Fairbanks was ahead of the game when we first had gold strikes, because the vast majority of the early prospectors and miners came from Dawson, where they had already worked several years in frozen ground.
Yeah.
So there was a certain level of progress and a learning curve that didn't have to be relearned. So Fairbanks was doing pretty well. These early boilers were, of course, the thing that really helped, being able to do steam points as compared to what would regular just building a fire over something.
Which, yeah.
That has got to be one of the statistics.
We're going to melt you 6 inches at a time with a big fire.
And if you think about that number, you'd work for a week before you couldn't see over the rim of your pit.
I know.
That had to have been pretty heartbreaking. Well, the prospectors from Dawson then had this experience. They were versed in the use of boilers as thawing agents, so the hot water, still hot water and steam thawing in those days. It was before cold water thawing. And we're not going to talk today about dredging, because that came much later. This early prospectors then lacked portable boilers. And in turn, they built wood fires directly on top of the frozen deposit. They were successful at thawing the deposit, but the problem is they didn't thaw straight down. They thawed everywhere. So he ended up with kind of a big irregular hole that the sides would cave in. It took a lot of work to really exploit that. They also ended up with a lot more expense to extract the shafts, because normally you'd get a shaft just big enough for a guy to fit through and bring your buckets of material up. These pits, you never know how big they could be. Every time you're moving gravel, you're not making money. The Fairbanks district then had fairly low capacity in the early boilers. The earliest was pick and shovel work. Of course, that's what the prospectors could carry. there were small boilers that were called doghouse because they were about the size of a doghouse. And then there were vertical boilers that were just about the size of a normal person standing up. And those were able to produce the steam that was needed. If you look at some of the early reports, they talk about boiler horsepower. I never quite understood that, I'll admit, for a while. And I found out that boiler horsepower refers to the amount of energy it takes to raise 1 gallon of water to steam in 1 minute. So a lot of times you'll see like a 150 horsepower boiler. That means it could flash 150 gallons of water to steam per minute.
Wow.
Well, by the spring of 1904 then, larger capacity boilers that were brought in by the steamships were coming, and they were installed on a lot of the claims, and they quickly replaced the manual technologies. Also, replacing the manual technologies was good. The burning fire method left a lot of carbon monoxide in the shafts, and there were miners killed from that. The introduction of these technologies and intense prospecting increased the production and profits of the district and increased the development of the Fairbanks region. While the type of placer dictates the tools and techniques, miners in the Fairbanks area found both shallow low-grade deposits and deeper high-grade deposits, deposits that miners worked with different methods. The shallow deposits were exploited with open-cut mining. The processes that exposed the largest amount of bedrock in the shortest amount of time and allowed for an expedited extraction of the deposit. The deeper placers were subject to drifting, which focused on handling the smallest amount of the valueless material possible and allowed for a greater profit by concentrating more on the pay dirt at bedrock rather than removing overburden. Traditional open-cut mining techniques like scraping and derricking were successful in exploiting the shallow high-grade deposits, yielded high profits for the early miners in the district. The early miners quickly exhausted these high-grade deposits, often with inefficient tools and technologies, which left a fair bit of gold still in the ground. With the highest grade deposits exhausted, open-cut miners turned their attention to the plentiful low-grade deposits within and around the district, and they attempted to use the same traditional scrapers, but the cost of operating the plant and inefficient wash plants made that economically unfavorable.
Ah.
But that was good in a way,
mm-hmm.
because at Dawson and here in Fairbanks both, when they wore out those high-grade deposits and didn't have the money to buy other equipment, dredges were just becoming a technology that could be used. And at that point, the life of both Dawson and Fairbanks was extended by over 30 years in each camp by bringing in dredges to come in and suck off all the rest of the low deposits, low-grade deposits, that the pick and shovel and small guys hadn't got. Well, the different techniques we use, all of placer mining traditionally is commonly referred to as poor man's mining, but by the time you get to dredges, that obviously wasn't totally true. Panning is simple hand tools. It's the preferred method used in the initial prospecting. The main tools are the gold pan, picks, shovels, and we know a gold pan's a shallow metal dish with sloping side that you put your material in, you agitate it by hand, you pick out the bigger pieces you don't need, and eventually you work the gold to the bottom of the pan in the crease between the bottom of the side. If time was available, they would dry it out and often take a little straw and blow the fines away and leave the gold, or you could also pour it into a handkerchief and let it dry while you continue to work on pans. An experienced miner with an ample water supply can work around 100 pans in a day, which is 6/10 cubic yards of dirt. So if you could do 100 pans a day over in parts of Dawson where they were hitting some 40 cent per pan loads, that was $40 a day, which was good money in its day.
Oh, yeah.
And The rocker then is maybe the next level up. It's a tiered wooden box and looks just like what it says. Looks like the old baby cradle, and you rock it back and forth. It was best used by two miners. The one would engage the box while the other shovels alluvium in. The upper level of the rocker box is basically a screen. The alluvium is shoveled in. Add water to wash it through. It helped disintegrate the clays in the mixture. And have a handle on the side. It could be rocked to and fro and forward and back. As the screen's shaken, the alluvium passes through and falls onto a sloping surface called an apron. The apron catches that, and it everything that passes through the screen, it's covered usually with canvas or a material called miner's moss or even carpet, which is left loose. That made small pockets that captured most of the gold. The alluvium that passes over the apron falls into an inclined base of the rocker box, which is flat and has perpendicular strips called riffles. And I think most of our listeners would be familiar with sluice box and riffles.
Yeah.
They're normally an inch, in that day, were an inch wide, three quarters high. They collected the remaining heavy material that passed through the base of the box. Normally had 1 to 2 rockers, and they were rounded blocks, again, which allowed sort of a oscillating motion as needed. The debris from the riffles are transferred to the gold pan then for the final cleanup. It's interesting how often the gold pan comes back, no matter what you're
doing.
It's
always at the fines at the end.
It is. And they occasionally then would use trenches or some other method at the discharge end to try to get the debris away from the wash plant. Now, two men working a rocker can process 3 to 5 cubic yards of gravel in a 10-hour day. So somewhere around 400-plus pans, which you can see how much of an improvement that is. Long Tom was a slightly different type. It was about 6.5 feet long, open box with perforated screen, and at its discharge end, it had a riffle box that trapped the gold. The discharge end is about a third wider, so the water slows down a little bit, which means that your fines don't continue to wash on through.
Yeah.
The Long Tom, though, required an ample supply of water. And really, if you were to go out this afternoon, go up Goldstream, Fish Creek, some of those, there's not really a lot of water in the summer. And some years, there was much less than there is this year. Well, two men working a Long Tom could process an estimated 6 cubic yards of gravel in a 10-hour day. Sluicing is just the washing of gravels. Pretty much now everybody uses steel sluice boxes that does that type of mining. We see them around, and probably everybody has seen videos or something of a sluice box operating. It works on a continual slight slope and uses gravity. It's basically an acceleration of the natural process which separated the deposit to begin with. The box is dependent on the composition of the alluvium. If it's very loose, a shorter box will suffice. Compact, it takes a longer box to bust it up a bit more. The sluice is the most efficient means of washing large amounts of pay dirt. A variety of methods where it could be used, everything from shovels, water, scraper buckets, wheelbarrows, now backhoes, tracked dozers to shove the material into the box. And ground sluicing was simply a method of flushing water across and leaving the gold trapped in the cracks and irregularities in the bedrock to be concentrated and then run through a sluice box. All of these things were fairly inexpensive in the original day, and mostly could be made with wood sawn from local trees. One of the other things that was interesting was booming, where you'd build a dam and let the water build up and then pull up a trap door, and the water would flush out with a lot more energy, and that was where you had larger gravel and more coarse nuggets. You could do a lot more flushing at the time.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break and give you some bumper music, a little bit of Aerosmith Walk This Way. There's some Fox News, state news, commercials, and weather, and we will be back.
Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM.
Fox News, I'm John Saucier. President Trump holding a bilateral meeting with the Crown Prince and Prime Minister of Bahrain at the White House. Tells reporters they're trying to make new trade agreements with multiple countries.
We've made deals with a lot of great places, but we had one yesterday, you know, that was announced. We have another one coming up, maybe with India. I don't know. We're in negotiation.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio gave us an update on recent violence in Syria.
We've been engaged with them all morning long and all night long with both sides, and we think we're on our way towards a real de-escalation and then hopefully get back on track in helping Syria build a country and arriving at a situation there in the Middle East is far more stable.
Israeli forces launching airstrikes into the capital of Damascus, reportedly killing several people. Israel says they're defending the Druze religious minority group. Syria says they have a renewed ceasefire with Druze leaders. America's listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
Alaska Coast Guard gets a major boost. This is your latest Alaska News Minute. Earlier this month, President Trump signed a bill with almost $25 billion for new Coast Guard construction, including $9 billion for new icebreakers and $300 million for new Coast Guard facilities in Juneau. Friday, Rear Admiral Bob Little, the new commander of the Coast Guard in Alaska, said it remains to be seen how those new ships will be used and when they will arrive in the Arctic. Alaska has the largest commercial fishing fleet in the United States and produces more than half of the nation's seafood. Key maritime trade routes between Asia and California run through Alaska waters, and cruise ships carry more than 1.5 million passengers through the southeast of Alaska every year. Altogether, the Coast Guard in Alaska employs almost 2,500 people. For more Alaska news, log on to KFARradio.com.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
One night, one stage, one legendary band. Switchfoot is coming to Rock Fairbanks. Catch the Grammy-winning alt-rock icons Friday, July 25th at the Tenenbaum Valley State Fairgrounds. Switchfoot is known for smash hits like Dare You to Move, Stars, Love Alone is Worth the Fight, and Meant to Live. Gates open at 6 p.m. Music starts at 7. Switchfoot hits the stage at 8 p.m. sharp. Fuel up with local food trucks. Check out vendors. And if you're 21 or older, enjoy adult beverages with a valid ID. It's an all-ages show. Under 21 must be with a parent or guardian 21 plus. Tickets are on sale now at ericksonevents.com. Don't wait. This show will sell out. Switchfoot, live at the Tenenbaum Valley State Fairgrounds Friday, July 25th.
This is an Ericsson Unlimited event.
Valdez, Alaska.
Where the only traffic you'll find is the school of salmon underneath your boat. Come experience excellent fishing and a hometown atmosphere in Valdez. Don't have a boat? No problem. When the pink and silver salmon are running, you can catch them from shore. There are miles of shoreline on Dayville Road, so grab a fishing pole, spoon, or spinner, and don't forget your fillet knife. You're going to catch some fish. Visit ValdezFishDerbies.com for more information on Fishing Valdez and Valdez Fish Derby events.
Our smile, it says it all. So take care of that smile without breaking the bank at Affordable Dental Care. It's dental care for the entire family. New patient exams, including full mouth x-rays for cash price patients, starting at just $79. Crowns as low as $900 and implants for less than $3,000. They're also an in-network provider for a long list of dental plans. They also offer payment plans and accept care credit. Downtown on 14th Avenue, call 374-3888 or online at affordabledentalcare.com.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio here. How you doing, sir?
I'm very well, Dave.
Mining. That's why we're here.
It absolutely is. Even to this day, there's still more miners out and working than we would think. And with Pogo and Fort Knox, a lot of good jobs in town with those.
Very much so.
Well, the mining methods and technologies in Fairbanks and Dawson somewhat parallel each other and came on at nearly the same time. Hydraulic mining uses a lot of high-pressure stream of water. It disintegrates the placer deposits Hydraulic mining does, though, require an ample amount of water under high head to be economically viable. So Davidson's Ditch, all of the ditches over in Dawson, and the pump house, those brought a lot of water for hydraulic stripping. And hydraulic stripping is by far, once the system is in place, you're just sitting there using gravity to power your whole system. Additionally, you need a fairly steep grade of bedrock, though, for the alluvium to be moved toward the sluice boxes. Water for hydraulicking is generally acquired from dams, ditches, flumes, and they carry the water down to the work area, increasing the pressure all the way as it moves, to a nozzle, finally, at the discharge end, which is called a giant or a monitor. And you know, of course, that Wise Mike Stepovich here of Fairbanks invented the monitor that is commonly used and that you still see on fire apparatus. The greatest expense in hydraulic mining is generally related to creating the infrastructure used in transporting the water. Once that's done, it's very economic. In arid locations, the initial expense is generally too great. You usually have to go too far to get it, and you always have to, of course, worry about loss of water due to evaporation. Well, drift mining. It's a technique to extract gold-bearing alluvium within deep placers. It entails sinking a shaft to bedrock, running perpendicular drifts from the shaft along the pay streak within the placer deposits. Here in the Fairbanks area, this type of mining really shaped our early mining history. And our deposits forced miners to adapt the system of drift mining used in the Klondike to our local conditions. Extraction within the drifts is organized in a manner similar to what's called longwall coal mining. And so that was not an unknown technology. They didn't have to invent everything themselves. They had to modify it to local conditions. Miners extract material from the farthest reaches of the drift and then work backward toward the shaft and the gangways in a broader pattern. Miners in Fairbanks employed drift mining extensively, reaching portions that were far ahead of California's drift mining at the time. In 1908, 85% of the 300 placer mining operations in the Fairbanks district were using drift mining. It was nearly abandoned by the 1920s due to the depletion of the valuable deep placers and the introduction of the dredges. The development of drift mining defined early placer mining in Alaska's interior. And again, that type of mining, where they eventually wore the deposits out, led to the miners abandoning, selling the claims, and then those consolidated claims could be used for the dredges. Well, the process is separated easily into winter mining and summer mining. Winter mining is principally extractive, focusing on underground development, removal of ore. The gravels extracted during the winter are hoisted from the shafts and dumped into large conical piles called, oddly enough, winter dumps. And the winter dumps are continually built up until thawing commences and water begins to flow in the ditches. Once present, the water is used to thaw the still frozen ore in the dumps, as well as wash it over sluice boxes that are built into the dump. Eliminates the need for additional transport. The water from the ditches also transports the waste matter or debris away from the mine through flumes. If you follow the Chattanooga to where it goes into Minto Flats and Goldstream, their mouths are several miles away from where they were in 1900 by the amount of debris that was sent downstream.
I'm sure.
So summer mining includes surface and subsurface development, extracting, washing the alluvium. The subsurface development undertaken during the summer in drift mining required constructing timbered infrastructure, as all the heat brought in would sometimes overthaw the material and create hazardous or non-mineable conditions. The underground infrastructure was constructed to counter the introduction of the warm summer air. One of the things that happened in Dawson when they first started dredging, they found out a lot of these old shafts and adits had filled with water, which had frozen, and the dredges were almost unable to pound through those big solid ice shafts that went out to the side. Well, prospecting then's the initial process. You search for profitable ground. You need to prospect an area to find enough gold to see if it's worth developing. Prospecting's undertaken through a variety of methods, from very inexpensive techniques like pick and pan, more technologically advanced equipment like the churn drill. There were a lot of churn drills used, particularly by the FE company here in Fairbanks. If you go past Mr. Reeves' place out there on the Stees Highway, you'll see a number of churn drills setting up there. Well, the equipment used then included some of the material for extraction, like the pick and shovel, hoisting, hand windlass, and testing, again, the small gold pan. In the Fairbanks district, additional steps were required in sinking the shaft due to the frozen alluvium. Early miners in Fairbanks relied on thawing techniques used in the Klondike, everything from fires to heated rocks, buckets of hot water. When the steam thawing equipment came here, it was rather quickly because they'd already learned the value in the Klondike, and we had riverboat transportation from day one. The steam became the primary thawing agent and was employed in the placer fields of the district, generated through a system of portable boilers and steam points, hoses, and pipes. Well, here in Fairbanks, the early miners incorporated prospect pits rather than mechanized sampling churn drills. They came at a much later date. The pay streak's depth made the cost of prospecting very high, as miners sometimes had to extract up to 300 feet of overburden just to reach the gold. The frozen state of the alluvium added additional costs, with the miners spending an exorbitant amount of money and time fueling the boilers to thaw. You couldn't cut your own firewood and work the mine in the same year. Well, once the prospect pit or shaft is sunk, miners panned samples of the alluvium near the bedrock. If the samples were promising, development of the area ensued. If the prospect yielded poor results, more prospects were sunk within the claim area. Sinking a test pit to 300 feet with the possibility of locating an unprofitable pay streak was a pretty costly risk for miners in the Fairbanks area, and a lot of them went broke because of that. Most regions in Alaska had around 20 prospect shafts per claim, but due to the deep placers, miners in the Fairbanks district routinely sunk an average of only 4. This lack of prospecting and the selective sampling of the most valuable alluvium located at bedrock led to the initial failure of many mines. Selective sampling enabled miners testing only the gold-bearing material near bedrock, and it gave false high results often. So because of that, in doing so, many of the miners forgot, in the excitement of seeing the gold, to account for the additional material and cost needed to fully develop a mine. Well, once located and proved, the full-scale development of the area could commence. At this point, the haphazard thawing and excavating was over, and the good shafts were sunk. They were squared up and used the steam points to thaw through the muck. The average dimension of a shaft was 6 to 7 feet square. On average, shafts could be sunk at a pace of 5 to 8 vertical feet per day during a two-man shift. At the bottom of the shaft, they would have a void, and that acted as a sump to provide drainage within the mine and permitted the hoist bucket to set flush with the ground, so it was easier to put a wheelbarrow load into. Well, shafts were used primarily for winter mining or rarely cribbed, since the permafrost will retain shape and dimension of the shaft. If the shaft will be used in the summer, It will then be cribbed, usually with timbers, moss chinking, sort of like a little small log cabin going down into the ground. Moss and gravel were always used because of their availability and inexpensiveness. The most important cribbing then is located at the top end of the shaft, called the collar, and near the bottom end where everybody's working. And the cribbing wasn't used at all out on the edges because that was the gold that was pulled out quickly. And if it started to slump, no one cared.
There you go. Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Online exhibit entry for the 2025 Tanana Valley State Fair is now open. Non-perishable drop-offs are Friday, July 18th from 4 to 7 p.m. and Saturday the 19th from 1 to 6 p.m. Junior perishable drop-off is Thursday, July 24th, 1 to 6, and adult perishable drop-off is Tuesday, July 29th from 1 to 6. You'll find all of these along with all the drop-off dates and times on your free fair app or visit them online at tvsfa.org.
It's really hot this summer. How hot?
Hot enough to get a smoking hot deal with Denali Industrial Supply and Milwaukee Tools Red Hot July Sale. Stop by Denali Industrial Supply this July and check out the hot savings on the latest Milwaukee power tools. Impress your neighbors with your better chainsaw, drill, mower, or blower. And there's much, much more. These hot Milwaukee deals are only through the month of July, only while supplies last, and only at Denali Industrial Supply. Denali Industrial Supply, 1499 Van Horn Road. Just look for the big red roof.
When friends and family gather, it's time to lift each other up with delicious food and beverage from Tommy G's Meat and Sausage. All their beef is certified Angus beef, making it truly the best of the best. They pride themselves on superior quality, service, and consistency. Whether it's their cowboy cut ribeyes, lamb shanks, or even their ground chuck, you know you're getting the very best in Alaska because there is no other place like this in Alaska. Stop by Tommy G's Meat and Sausage today, 3290 Pegger Road. It's no longer dinner with friends and family. It's an experience.
The perfect place for lunch is right downtown at the Red Lantern Bar and Grill. We've got a brand new menu, and it's all about fresh flavors and lunchtime favorites. From your favorite salads to the best burger in town, we have stack sandwiches and lighter options that don't scrimp on taste. There's something for everyone, perfect for a business lunch, midday break, or catching up with friends. We're located downtown on Noble Street inside the Westmark Hotel. Lunch is served every day from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. The Red Lantern, where your lunch hour just became the best part of your day.
KFAR weather.
High of 73 today under partly cloudy skies. Easterly winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. Cloudy skies tonight, 56. Cloudy skies expected tomorrow. Slight chance for isolated showers. Daytime highs approaching 72. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Derek Height.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. Guess who's in the studio with me? Nick Nugent. Not Ted, Nick.
See, a little bit of difference and I could have been famous.
You know, just play me some Cat Scratch Fever and you can do it.
There you go. Well,
I've been waiting about 5 years to say that.
Looking at drift mining, which again was the way mining was done in Fairbanks up till the advent of the dredge, everything that could be done without cribbing was, but when the cribbing was put in, it was often fairly extensive if the soil was a little loose and they were worried about cave-ins. The horizontal shafts then running horizontal, excuse me, from the shaft is the main drift or gangway, and that would be fairly heavily cribbed in most instances for safety, so that if something started to happen in one of these side drifts, all the miners could run over to a cribbed-in spot and escape the mine. The gangways run the entire length of the proposed working area, as much as 200 feet from the shafts. Excavation is similar to the shaft, but working horizontally with steam points thawing and picks pulling the gravel loose. In 1905, the development of a tunnel cost $6.25 per foot, including thawing, excavating, timbering, laying track, and tramming or moving the pay dirt. That is a pretty good chunk of money for 1905. So even drift miners were at a financing level and a requirement for capital far above your simple pick and shovel guys in the shallow mining days. Well, transversely off the gangway are linear excavations, known as the drifts. They occurred at intervals of about 50 to 100 feet, and they would go out to the edge of the ore zone, and working backward then toward the gangway, miners were only concerned with extraction within the drift. They really tried not to extract anything they didn't have to. Drifts run to the end of the pay streak as much as 300 feet from the main, excavated in this retreating method. As they do that, they did some stoping of the drifts, which was often just nothing more than leaving a frozen pillar of dirt there to help support the ceiling. They didn't lose enough gold that was a problem. Excavation within the drift, again, was steam points driven in and working. So you're always working in 100% humidity and in what could have been pretty physically rough conditions for a 10-hour shift. During the thawing, a nominal amount of steam and heat escape from the pipe fittings, and that contacts the roof, which begins to thaw. So a lot of times those places had to be temporarily at least buttressed so they wouldn't have dangerous rock falls off the ceiling. Well, the excavation tapers off as the miners retreat back toward the shaft, leaving a sufficient block of frozen ground to support the gangways. Once at the shaft, the wheelbarrow was dumped into a bucket that was hoisted to the surface by a windlass, powered either by hand or animal, and later by steam. With drifts extending over 300 feet from the shaft, the hauling of pay dirt with wheelbarrows became exceedingly inefficient, so small-gauge track and mine cars were installed in several of the locations. Small elevated platforms were built that allowed the car to efficiently dump into the hoist. On average, the mine carts varied in size but held 5 to 6 wheelbarrow loads of pay dirt, which on average ran equivalent to the full capacity of the hoisting bucket. The majority of workers in drift mining operations were engaged in underground mining or at the surface tending the hoist, dump box, and ancillary equipment. The hoisting system at the mine dictated the size of the workforce. If the mine were equipped with a large hoist, it could process a greater amount of pay dirt, obviously, leading to an increase in employment of underground miners. Underground miners worked in teams of 5 to 6 miners, each of whom was responsible for picking, loading, and hauling material. Underground laborers were paid a flat rate. They were expected to process 75 to 125 wheelbarrows of pay dirt per 10-hour day. Assuming that an underground miner was working a 200-foot drift and handling 100 wheelbarrows a day, he would be pushing that wheelbarrow nearly 10 miles on a given day, in addition to the pick work excavating the shaft itself.
Wow. Ready for a phone call?
I am.
Good morning here on KFAR Radio with Nick Nugent, and your name is?
Good morning, Dave. This is Phil.
Hello, Phil. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. You know, you're talking about dredges. Back in the late 70s, I worked on Dredge 6 and Dredge 5 up in Nome.
Wow.
I worked out in the thaw field, too. And, Nick was talking about using steam. Well, they used cold water thawing. And it was like either a 2 or 3 year process to get that ground thawed. And we'd put the pipes in about 80 foot down. And your job out in the thaw field was to wear rain gear and carry a pipe wrench. And all you did was walk around and listen to the pipes make sure the water was running through them. And if it wasn't, you just have to rotate them, possibly jack them up just a little bit to clear them. But it was quite the process. Another thing, you're talking about valuable ground, drift mining.
Mm-hmm.
I know of someone who had a drift put down. They ended up going down about 80 feet. And this is way back to the early 1900s. But at the time, I believe gold was about $8 an ounce. A shovel full had $2 worth of gold in it. The problem was the shaft ended up getting flooded out. It almost killed some people.
Oh, boy.
And so the owner just put the kibosh on the whole thing. And
shut her down, yeah.
Shut it down, yeah. And that ground is still there.
Well, thank you for the phone call. We got to finish up our show here. Are you enjoying this?
Oh, absolutely. This is great.
Isn't the second and fourth Wednesdays of the month my favorites and yours?
Well, I really look forward to it. Yeah, getting either Nick on there or Joni.
You got it. You take care, buddy. You have a great day. Bye.
Okay, you too. Bye now.
Well, during the mining boom years, 1902 to 1910, miners in the district practiced this drift mining. That was really all they were doing at that point, pretty much. Drift mines employed up to 50 workers underground and excavated up to 200,000 square feet of pay dirt in a season. At the surface, labor was defined by machinery. Each man was paid by the piece of machinery he ran. Boiler makers, hoist operators. Interestingly, the surface laborers were considered skilled professionals and were paid higher wages than the poor guy breaking his back underground. And in the winter, the underground miners were paid even less than in the summer.
Less production, simple as that.
Yeah, and apparently that's what they saw and looked at. But I thought the worse the conditions, the less you made. No wonder so many guys left for the winter. Well, the hoist operators fueled the boiler, controlled the flow of material into and out of the shaft. Depending on the size of the hoist and the efficiency of the dumping system, they could receive and dump a bucket, which was about a yard or so, in less than a minute. And that required a pretty proficient hoist operator, so you can see why they were the well-paid guys.
Yes.
It's just an interesting story to me, the drift years. We don't think of that as much. You know, a lot of the pictures you see were always the surface guys, and then, of course, we know the dredges, but yet this really big piece that kept the camp
going. Drift mining, yeah.
Was drift mining.
Thank you so much. Appreciated
this one.
You're quite
welcome.
Really did. You know, it's but we must part ways for the next few months. You'll still be on second Wednesday of the month, while I'm taking my election hiatus, but that's okay. I'll be in the booth a lot anyway. What the heck? And so, what are you thinking of next?
Well, next month I was thinking about doing one on the Josiah Spur and looking for the origin and the route of the Kuskokwim.
Wow,
an area that we haven't talked too much about, Southwest Alaska.
Not yet,
man.
Fairbanks, that is our show for today. Appreciate you listening. Have a great day. Hopefully tomorrow, pancakes will be available in the Sadler's parking lot. Oh, my God, that was crushing for me. I'll see you tomorrow. You have a great day.